order the Community and Regional Affairs Committee. Today, the time today is 8:05, Tuesday, February 1st. We had planned to start with a presentation on the Denali Commission, Rural Communities. Joel Niemeyer, the federal co-chair for the commission, is going to give a presentation. However, he's not here, so we're going to start with our bill. First bill up in the committee is HB 65, Senior Citizen Housing Development Fund Grants. And Tim Clark from Representative Bryce Edgman's office is here to present the bill. So, Tim, before I get started, I want the record to reflect that Vice Chair Neil Foster is present, Representative Gardner, and Representative Dan Sadler. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Chair Munoz. For the record, my name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Bryce Edgman. The representative wanted me to pass along his regrets that he couldn't be here this morning. He's up in finance for a meeting. The bill, HB 65, is relatively simple as legislation goes. It, we hope, would benefit seniors across the state by including regional housing authorities among the entities eligible for grants through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund. Presently, the fund is open to municipalities and 501c3 and 4 nonprofits. And that nonprofit status is based on a fairly strict Internal Revenue Service definition based on the Act of 1954. There have been some regional housing authorities that have gone to the considerable trouble of qualifying as nonprofits under that definition, but it it requires quite a bit of effort. They have to form subsidiary corporations, and the application process itself is quite lengthy and laborious, and I believe I could be corrected if I'm wrong by AHFC officials who should be online. I also believe that that status has to be updated on somewhat of a regular basis. Alaska has 14 regional housing authorities. They're some of the most experienced affordable housing developers in the state. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation supports the bill. The bill carries a zero fiscal note. The fund being already funded at $4.5 million in the governor's proposed budget. This will have no effect on costs. It will only allow the fund managers to more effectively allocate the monies available.
Excuse me, Tim. Please let the record note that Representative Alan Osterman has joined us. Continue, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We do, I believe, have online Elaine Mello, Planning Officer for Elder Housing Grants with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Mark Romick, who's the Director of Planning and Program Development at AHFC. Stacey Schubert, the AHFC Ledge Liaison. Heather Arnett, who's the Statewide Administrator of the Association of Alaska Housing Authorities. And Dan Duane, who's the Executive Director of Aleutian Housing Authority, and I believe a president of the statewide association. Any questions I can't handle, I hope they can.
As a process item, if we could have a motion to bring the bill before the committee, please, HB 65.
I so move.
Okay, it has been moved by Representative Foster. Continue, please.
That's about all I have in terms of introduction. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them. So.
Are there questions for Tim today? Representative Gardner?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to make one little comment. I think we try to avoid calling things a simple bill. It can be the kiss of death, so let's just call it straightforward.
Note taken.
Please let the record note that Representative Sharon Cisna has joined us today. Thank you, Sharon. Are there additional questions for Tim? Yes. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tim, through the chair, how much more money would be available to the regional housing authorities with this change? What's the pot of money available to them?
The fund is the appropriation for this year is likely to be $4.5 million, which is the governor's request. Excuse me, Representative Sadler, through the chair. In terms of the projects funded, usually money is coming from the Senior Citizens Housing Development Fund, are just one piece of the a collection of funding from different sources. You will see in the bill packet that there are three examples of Senior Citizen Housing Development Fund projects, and all of them are. All of them demonstrate, you know, a fairly diverse collection of funding sources. I believe in the first example, the total development cost for $5.1 million, and the Senior Citizen Housing Development Fund provided about 20%. In the second example, total costs were $2.3 million, and the fund provided about 50%. And in the third example, with funds at around or total development costs at around $2.4 million, the Senior Citizen Housing Development Fund provided about 16%.
Thank you.
Additional questions? I have a couple of questions, please. What is the balance of the fund?
I believe that might be a question for Elaine Mello or Mark Romick, but I believe that they try to exhaust the fund's resources on an annual basis.
Okay.
And it's replenished on an annual basis.
Okay. And is the history of the fund to get an annual appropriation roughly equivalent of what the current appropriation is?
It has been for the past several years in the $4.5 million range.
Okay. And can you give some examples of projects that have been funded in the past?
Yes. The let's see. In this first example, it's a retirement community in Fairbanks with 20 units. That of the three examples is the most ambitious. It was a $5.1 million project. The second is located in Houston, which I have to admit, I'm not sure where that town is in the state.
Oh.
But,
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Just for clarification for members of the committee, it's in the Mattsu Valley, kind of beyond Palmer, Wasilla, and out the road toward Denali.
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Gardner. The Mattsu Valley project in Houston is six units and at a cost of $2.3 million. And the final project in Togiak, which happens to be in Representative Edgman's district, so I'm more familiar with its geographical location. Apologies. But, it is another six-unit project at a cost of $2.4
million. And traditionally, the money is seen as gap, not financing, but gap granting. Is that correct? It's meant to bridge the gap between you know, helping to pencil out a project, so to speak.
In many cases, that's what I'm told, Madam Chair. The according to officials, you know, associated with housing authorities, their funding for even a single project is usually quite diverse. It can include, very often includes, housing and urban development, HUD funding, okay, both through the Office of Native American Programs and through straight HUD funding. There are other sources within the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation they mm-hmm. can turn to. There's the Denali Commission has been very active over the years, and even U.S. Department of Agriculture and Rural Development, among others.
And then one final question. Has the fund historically been able to meet the requests that have been generated to the fund or that have been submitted to the fund?
My understanding is that at times there are grant applicants turned away, but that the number of applicants in a given year turned away versus those who are awarded grants is not too great in proportion. I mean, the majority of grant applicants, so far as I know, and you know, going back a handful of years, majority of applicants do receive funding, and once again, AHFC could correct me if this statement is wrong, but I believe that you know, they have talked about this bill allowing them to be more effective in allocation of these funds. Okay. So it's possible that rather than applicants being turned away outright, it's just that a larger number of worthy projects would be funded, but perhaps at a slightly lower amount for each okay. project.
Okay. All right. Are there additional questions of Tim? Yeah. Yes. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Question I have is just regarding the origin of this bill. Was there a particular regional housing authority, you don't have to name which, if so, that said, hey, we're identifying this need and would like to see, you know, something to fill the gap here?
Representative Foster, through the chair, my understanding is that there always is a need for increased senior housing. It's the fastest growing segment of our population. I believe that this has been among the priorities for the statewide association of housing authorities for some time. So it was. Representative Foster, through the chair, it was specifically brought to us by Dan Duane, the director of the Aleutian Housing Authority, but as much perhaps in his capacity as an official with the statewide organization.
Thank you. Very good to hear. Another question?
Sure.
Thank you. In terms of are you receiving feedback from the regional housing authorities saying, we do have projects that are planned for this year or next year, and if so, I'm just trying to get a sense of what the demand is.
I would have to conjecture based on, Representative Foster, through the chair, I would have to conjecture based on my discussions with AHFC and the housing authorities that there won't be a mad rush toward the fund. There won't be a dramatic increase in pressure on the fund, but that there are always around the state senior housing projects, you know, being planned or at least hoped for.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the chair, Tim. Right now, as the law is crafted, municipalities and 501c3s and c4s are eligible. My tax code knowledge is a little bit limited. Could you describe for me who those 501c3s and 4s are and maybe how they feel about increased competition for the grant funds?
Representative Sattler, through the chair. That was one of my first questions to AHFC, which is, did they anticipate any active disappointment on the part of the nonprofits that have played a role so far, and they did not anticipate that, mainly because the fund, as you can see in recent years, it's the applicants have numbered just in the 2 to 8 to 9 figure. So, and in terms of actual specific organizations, I have to admit I don't have a name or two in front of me. I could prevail upon the Alaska Housing Finance Authority, Elaine Mello or Mark Romick, for an example. However, I have the feeling they may have been anticipating the Denali Commission.
We still have overview, right? Individuals online, and we'll get to them in a minute. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think my question follows Representative Sadler's question, really. Under the status quo, the municipalities and 501c3s and 4s who can participate in this program, if we expand that, is it anticipated that different groups will now participate, or simply that they won't have to, the people who now are jumping through hoops to have the subsidiary nonprofits will have an easier time of accessing?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, the number of the 14 housing authorities around the state, the number that have managed to acquire the 501c3 and 4 status is only a handful, I think 3 or 4. So the bill would essentially save the other housing authorities from having to go through that process in order to qualify. So it will, according to my understanding, it will greatly increase the number of entities within the housing authorities that would qualify.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. One more question, Representative Sadler.
Who might, Tim, through the chairwoman, who might be the next organizations in line to try and get access to these grant funds? Are tribal councils, tribal housing authorities, if there are such things, going to want to come through that same opening that we're getting the regional housing authorities through?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, the regional housing authorities around the state are, in fact, native housing authorities, and many of them are administered through the area native associations. However, nonetheless, the their work as housing authorities is open to anyone in need in the community.
So then, just to clarify, so is there anybody else, any other organization who might want to follow on next year and say, this is great, we want a piece of this too?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, I believe that because the regional housing authorities are so closely identified with the regional native associations and entities, that this would actually take care of that desire.
Thank you, Tim. Okay, one more question, then we'll go to our people online, and we can ask additional questions. Representative Osterman.
Thank you. Who's ever online may be able to answer this also. The fiscal note, the Department of Revenue, we have one fiscal note with this bill, has zero for state cost to the state of Alaska yet. My thought is that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation pays a dividend to the state of Alaska every year, and will this eat into the dividend portion of to the state as an actual cost to the state?
Representative Osterman, through the chair, AHFC's interpretation is that it will cause no additional cost to the state. The with or without HB 65, the Senior Citizen Housing Development Fund would receive or has been included in the governor's proposed budget an appropriation of $4.5 million, and that won't change.
Thank you.
Can we, do you want to go to the people online first, and then we can answer, ask additional questions?
Absolutely.
Because I think the questions are probably more appropriate of the individuals that are online.
Good.
Okay, thank you. Mark Romick and Elaine Mello with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation are online, as well as Daniel Duami, with President of the Association of Alaska Housing Authority. Mark Romick, are you online and ready to speak?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Would you like to make a short statement and then be available for questions, please?
I think, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Clark did a great job, and I don't have anything further to add other than that Alaska Housing supports this bill, and we're available for questions.
Okay. Representative Sisna had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and actually the questions from Representative Gardner and Sadler kind of reminded me to think about, and I may have missed this, and I'm sorry I was late, but we had a number of crises right up. Representative Gardner missed them by leaving early enough, right on our floor. Never mind. The issue that is constantly on my mind after having visited so many communities and seen some of the senior housing that obviously is very much valued and a very great part of numbers of communities I've been to, but what I am constantly reminded about is the need for studies to really make sure of what exactly is needed throughout Alaska and senior issues. I'm wondering if, in fact, there have been studies of housing in communities so that we, when we're doing things, are mindful of how they're being done and to do the kinds of incentives in the things we do to make sure that the housing is not only affordable in the short term, but the monies that are spent really are paying attention to the community needs in the long run, and especially when you're talking about seniors and the fact that so many communities now, the smaller ones, have been moving, members of the community have been moving into housing because of the costs of fuel that are not going down and the housing problems. So I just wanted to know if there's studies and how that impacts this.
Tim Clark, would you like to take that question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Sisna through the chair. The closest I could come to answering that question is to note that the grant process for the Senior Citizen Housing Development Fund is quite rigorous, and it includes that there must be a demonstrated need and feasibility for the project, and the applicant must also demonstrate that once built, the project can be sustained for the long term.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, what I have been fascinated in is that sustainability means different things to different people and seems to have different criteria. And the fuel prices are relatively new in their extremity. And so I'd love to know what that person, what whoever that entity is, what their meaning is of sustainability.
Yes.
Representative Sisna, through the chair, on that question, I would certainly have to defer to either Elaine Mello or Mark Romick, who are involved with the management of the fund.
Okay, Mark or Elaine, are you still with us?
Madam Chair, yes, we are. This is Mark Romick, and the short answer is that Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's definition of sustainability includes all the things that Representative Sisna said in terms of operating expenses, particularly utilities. And in that regard, the corporation requires that all property that we are involved in, either in a grant format or in loan financing, meet our state thermal standards for energy efficiency. And we encourage people, particularly out in the rural areas, to meet the highest level of energy efficiency that's kind of calculable, I guess you'd say, with our existing energy efficient system, that rating system that we have. And people are very creative in addressing those. We also encourage them to explore other kind of alternative heating systems than the traditional oil system. So energy efficiency and reducing operating expenses either through the heating system or using long-term maintenance-free materials and building, you know, very energy-efficient construction is an important part of the program that we have. And just as an aside, you might have heard in the news about the work that the Cold Climate Housing Research Center has been doing with the regional housing authorities in terms of trying to build far more sustainable housing out in rural Alaska, and examining all elements of the building system to try to maintain the property as low cost as possible, including you know, use of energy efficient appliances. And many of you know that Alaska Housing received some funding under the stimulus bill last year for energy efficient appliance rebate, and that's available to people with disabilities throughout Alaska that help reduce energy efficiency in the use of appliances.
Thank you, Mark. Representative Sisna.
Yes, and thank you very much. Thank you very much, both Chair and Mr. Carr. And my question or maybe suggestion would be, it would be really wonderful to be able to look more closely at those rating speculations to see how we're doing in terms of meeting the need that's out there, because we have more and more people, as those prices stay high in Alaska, that are really in deep trouble, and it would be really good to keep up on what's happening in terms of the research that's going on at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and that kind of thing. It really is critical to our communities.
Thank you, Representative Sisna. And we can take that topic up at another meeting. I'd be happy to help put together a presentation.
Okay. Great.
All right. Are there additional questions? Representative Sadler.
My last question, I think. Thank you, Madam Chairman. There's a reference in the letter from Dale McClure of BBHA about an Attorney General's opinion that apparently said that the regional housing authorities were not, contrary to HFC practice, eligible for these grants. Can you speak to him for a brief minute about what that AG opinion was and how it requested, how it came about, what it said?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, that refers back to the 501c3 and 4 status that demanded by the IRS. There was, I believe, at one point an assumption made because the regional housing authorities are nonprofits, and because they operate in ways that are almost precisely similar to a 501c nonprofit, there was a bit of confusion over whether or not they were in fact already eligible for the grant fund. And I believe the AG's opinion was, you know, to clarify that confusion. And when it was found, you know, definitively that they were not eligible unless they had gone to the trouble of forming subsidiaries and going through the application process, et cetera. That was one reason that they pursued legislation such as this.
Thank you. Are you finished? Okay. Yes. Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. It looks like you have support from the AHFC as well as numerous regional housing authorities, and so that looks very good. I wanted to just make a comment. The question I was going to ask is how many senior citizens do you expect that this bill would help to benefit? And currently, you had mentioned there was $4.4 million in the fund. Looking at the last project here, if you assume the 20% The grant funds 20% of the cost. Looks like just for the first example there, that was $1.1 million that was granted by the fund, and that project had 20 units. So I just extrapolated, and if you assume if you have four projects like that, then that's the $4.4 million right there that's currently in the fund, and that's 80 seniors. So I think that's a good number, and I just wanted to point that out. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Foster. Are there additional questions? Okay. Thank you for the individuals that have joined us online, and also Tim Clark from Representative Bryce Edgeman's office. Thank you for the presentation of the bill. We will bring it up for action at our next meeting. It's my intention to allow the public an opportunity to weigh in on anything before the committee before we actually move a bill. So we'll take it up at our next meeting. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. And next we have a presentation on the Denali Commission from Joel Niemeyer, the federal co-chair. Good morning.
Is the PowerPoint part of myself?
Did you work it?
Yes, I did.
We could certainly do this old school and walk you through the slides.
Also, we can show them how to navigate to the report online.
Start out with my apologies for arriving late and having the wrong room.
We did too. I went up, it was supposedly upstairs in 519.
What was that?
There was another meeting going on. I got caught up.
Okay. Thank you. I didn't know what to do with that.
Mr. Niemeyer, if you'd like to begin. Thank you for joining us today.
Certainly.
Thank you.
My name is Joel Niemeyer. I'm the federal co-chair of the Denali Commission. This is my second year serving, so I've been on board now for a year in this capacity. Prior to that, I was, I think, the sixth or seventh employee at the Denali Commission. In June of 99, I started and worked there for 5 years. Took a hiatus and worked for Rasmussen Foundation for five and then returned. So I have experience of watching the commission as it was rising in terms of appropriations, and now I'm experiencing as it is declining. And today I wanted to talk with you about some of the things that we're doing with regard to what we're faced with appropriations, as well as issues of the day. I'll go ahead and start with the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
What you'll see on the second slide is Denali Commission is based upon a model of regional commissions. First regional commission was Appalachia Regional Commission, which serves a number of states along Appalachia. A couple years after the Denali Commission was formed, Delta Regional Authority was established down in the Mississippi Delta. And then there are three other commissions which have been identified, but these three are the most prominent. Oh, I went the wrong way. I'll use that one. So we are an independent federal agency. We have ties to the U.S. Department of Commerce. But the way we work in the Act is that it's a fascinating story in my mind. What you have is you have Congress saying, we're going to entrust seven Alaskans to figure out where this money goes. We're not going to make the choice in D.C. We're going to make that choice with and trust seven Alaskans. And so what you have is Congress saying, here is $40 million in health. You decide where those health funds go. And so we have a federal co-chair, and then six non-federal commissioners. We have one independent today, Kathy Wasserman, who is a commissioner representing the Municipal League. So we have some general principles that were set forth in the Act. One is we try to have a small staff. We have an overhead requirement of 5% that in recent times with our decline in budget, OMB has waived that. But we still strive to have a small staff. We do all of our work through program partners. And as an example, in the last 5 years, we did an analysis of the state of Alaska. And the state of Alaska, for example, manages over 40% of our projects. And we use others, Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, so on and so forth. But I think the magic, again, coming back to it, is that seven Alaskans decide where these federal funds go. The next slide shows that since inception in 99, over $1 billion to 2,100 projects. And you can see the main areas of service. The most prominent one is energy, and that's predominantly bulk fuel storage tanks and rural power upgrade systems. I'd like to highlight the bulk fuel story. When Senator Stevens was first envisioning the commission, some of the discussion going about or it was at the time was, what is it that would be non-controversial? And at the time, there was a number of communities that were on or were put on notice by both the EPA and Coast Guard that they had failing bulk fuel farms and that they may be shut off. Now, as you all can probably imagine, if a community no longer has fuel delivered, that community is no longer sustainable. We were talking earlier about sustainability. Without oil, there is no sustainable community. So our first endeavors is significantly in bulk fuel. And we continue to this day do a lot of work with bulk fuel. But we expanded beyond that into power generation, so on and so forth. More recently, we've been working in partnership with the state of Alaska on the Emerging Energy Technology Program. And I think that's some really exciting opportunities. We have almost $300 million in health. The fascinating, I developed the health program when I was first at the commission. And for me, I think the fascinating story there, it gets back to this collaboration piece, is that one of the things we did early on is we said, if you try to build a clinic in Kotzebue, or in your region, and you have a grant program that's limited to $1 million, in your region, sir, you cannot build as big a facility if, say, in Kodiak, just because the price of construction is far different, 30-40% swings across the state. And so what we decided to do was, instead of base the program on costs, we decided based upon minimum need. And so we ended up bringing together 47 different stakeholder groups from across the state over the course of 10 months, having a series of meetings all across the state. And we were asking the question, what is the role of the commission, and how may we have a positive impact in the delivery of primary care in rural Alaska? And the end result was a matrix. I'm an engineer, so I love matrices. So. Was a matrix by which we identified the size of square footage for a clinic for a community based upon the number of residents and the isolation factor. So smaller communities got a smaller clinic, larger communities got a larger clinic, and then it wasn't funding that drove the size. It was the innate minimum needs of that community. So it's a fascinating story. I could talk about all these programs, but nevertheless, they are developed in partnership with many stakeholders throughout Alaska. The next slide shows the funding we have received over the years, many different funding sources. And then you can see the decline starting basically in FY7. And last year in FY10, we had $58 million. I am the president's budget is not yet out, so I'm not really allowed to talk publicly about what the FY11 budget is. But we'll come back to some of the issues of FY11 budget. Again, we talked about that the Denali Commission is one of a number of regional commissions, and this slide showing map of the U.S. shows the other commissions. And the important part of this slide is, as you can see, those other commissions touch many other states. Yeah. So they have many senators, they have many congressmen speaking on their behalf in Washington, D.C. Our commission has the least number of representatives in D.C. arguing on our behalf, and that's what this slide represents. I spoke earlier about partnership, and on this slide is I want to say we have over 150 partners, something like that, an extraordinary number of partners in those 2,100 grants. So some of them are listed on the right-hand side. But I wanted to show that we have partners on the federal end, we have partners at the state end, and then we have partners with nonprofits. So it is about who is available, who's best ready to work with the community and provide that service. Again, we come back to the question that we want a small staff. We could use our funding to have program managers to run the program, run the actual projects, but we don't do that. We farm the vast majority out to our program partners. This slide, I think, is a very important slide. It tells the story, the relationship between the state and Denali Commission, the partnership that has evolved over the years. So we did an analysis of the almost 900 commission projects funded in 5 years. And this is what we found out. The Denali Commission had $478 million available. The state provided $106 million to those specific projects. And then we leveraged another $461 million. So you can see that the state of Alaska has been a partner in directly funding our projects. And more importantly, the next component, they provide project management for a significant number. And that gets the story of the partnership.
Representative Gardner has a question. Yes.
Thank you very much. I came to the legislature, I believe, in 2005. I guess four, we do even years, yes. And it seems to me at that time when the Denali Commission did a presentation, there were and was looking for additional state assistance, there were people who said, but wasn't the Denali Commission supposed to be a federal project, federally funded, and the state wasn't going to have to pick that up? Is that accurate? It was kind of before my time, but that's my understanding. And what caught my eye here is that talking about state of Alaska participation, you started in 2005. What about historically?
Oh, yes. Representative Gardner through the chair. The relationship with the state started in the very beginning. The very first projects that we had, the bulk fuel projects, we worked with that Alaska Energy Authority. So our relationship with the state began from the very beginning. The reason why you see these dates, 2005, 2006, that was the analysis that we have done recently. We have not looked at the entire story going back to inception. We've only looked at the last 5 years. To the question that you raised about this is a federal project and that the state would not have to invest, I have heard similar stories like that. That when in the very early days, the story was is that there would not be a need to invest. And if you look at the original act, the act did not have a cost share match requirement. But then a couple years later, with the health program, we had a cost share match requirement. And the way we've been able to manage our health program is there have been direct intentional investments by the state of Alaska. For example, the Mental Health Trust Authority annually provides us funding to pay for the behavioral health component of a clinic. And so there have been those relationships, but I think they've been more organic. They haven't really been intentional. It is as they have developed. What we'll talk about in a little bit is why I believe that has to change.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
So the 4-to-1 match that's on your slide, I think.
The next slide.
One, has that been consistent or changed significantly? And then the second question, do the other states and counties, the other commissions, have comparable state participation?
Well, Representative Gardner, the chair, I'm still getting used to this. Allow me to address this slide and then address your question, if you would. This slide is an important part of the story. It talks about the investment of the state of Alaska in rural areas. We have, the major programs, health, energy, transportation, training, and the state also has been participating. And in this same time frame, of the $2.4 billion that the state has put into rural Alaska, $106 million of that went directly to our projects. But this is a fascinating story for me because let's look at the $300 million the legislature provided for weatherization all across the state. Denali Commission provided $1 million for training, and those training dollars went to mostly the housing authorities, mostly the regional housing authorities. And those crews, they trained up their crews so that they could be more effective and efficient with the state funds. So the credit for those improvements belongs with the state. But for our small investment of $1 million, possibly that $300 million went further. And so that's what this story talks about, is that collaborative programming. And I believe it also is a story of how the commission, in declining funding appropriations, how we can be more effective with state and other program partners, how we can leverage our dollars to find those unique opportunities so that state dollars and other dollars can go farther.
Yeah. Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Gardner.
Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not complaining because I think the Denali Commission does a fabulous job, and we would not be where we are as a state today were it not for the work that the Denali Commission does. I'm just trying to understand the history and sort of see how the original vision has shifted over the years, which we're going to see happening in terms of federal contributions, you know, down the road. I understand that. But I'm also interested in knowing if the other commissions are also kind of moving in the same way or if we have a different path.
Representative Gardner, through the chair. The story of the other commissions is somewhat similar to ours, but different in this way. The other commissions have legislation that specifically calls for the states to contribute for administration. So the administration of the actual agency is paid for in half by the states. The states have a required cost share match, generally 50%. So if we were to equate the statutes of the other commissions to the Denali Commission, the Denali Commission's $1 billion in the past 11 years, if that were equivalent to the other regional commissions, would have had a $1 billion match from their state programs. There is something that I find unique about how a lot of the other states work and how they use their regional commissions. Those regional commissions, they can use their dollars to match other federal funds. And so what I've seen is a trend where a lot of the other regional commissions, where the states will, instead of them, they come up with money. They will use this to try to help extend their projects by not having to come up with that match.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Continue, please.
As I spoke, we have four major programs: energy, health, transportation, training, and we also include governmental coordination as one of our programs. It, to me, is the magic of the commission. It is how we do business. We spoke about the how we develop the clinic prototypes and our health program. That is through governmental coordination.
Thank you. And before we continue, I'd like the record to note that we've been joined by Representative Alan Dick. Thank you. Thank you. Continue, please.
So let me run through a few quick slides here. Windmill turbines is a new feature that we've been doing the past number of years. It reduces the demand for oil for power generation, but it doesn't reduce the size of the generation plants we required. Bulk fuel farms is a significant component of what we do in the energy program. Health program is predominantly primary care clinics. We also do some work with rural hospitals, but predominantly most of our work has been with primary care clinics. Transportation program, it's our newest major program. What I'd like to highlight here is we have two aspects of the transportation program. One is surface roads, and the other is waterfront ports and harbors. And it's been my observation in this past year that if there's one area in which I think this state can collaborate with many stakeholders and deliver a message both back to D.C. and amongst ourselves, is it's waterfront ports and harbors. There really is a need in that area. There seems to be an awful lot, well, there seems to be programming, robust programming for surface roads, but I don't see it as much with waterfront ports and harbors. Our training program is a very important component. One of the elements that we strive to do with our training program is to train folks in rural settings on Denali Commission projects. So those clinics that we're building, those bulk fuel tanks, we're trying to train those folks to work on those projects. Some of the main points for today's discussion. I wanted to thank the legislature for two things. One is the $3 million that approving the $3 million that Governor Parnell put in his capital budget a couple years back. It's done two things. First off, is it was important because we discovered that we don't have the legal authority to accept it, which is we'll come back to the last point on the slide about reauthorization of the Denali Commission. But what we've done with the $3 million is we've worked with the state on about half of it will go to energy projects, and the other half will go to transportation. I have another slide about that. In the transportation program, we have a process by which we have a transportation advisory committee that reviews projects. This year, we had 41 waterfront and 31 roads. The transportation advisory committee met and rated and ranked the 41 waterfront projects, and we did not meet. We ran out of time to score the surface roads, and we'll be doing that in the first week of March. There will be a need for additional cost share match in the transportation program. I'll touch on that in a bit. In the health program, we no longer have behavioral health funding. We have some funding left over with behavioral health funds, and so what we have proposed is a suite of four behavioral health projects. Part of this is part of this request to the legislature is retweaking existing state funds. So there will be no new funds, but there will be action requested of the legislature. In our energy program, there is proposed legislation in the federal fiscal year 11 budget, which impacts the energy program, of what I'll speak about in the future, or in a bit. And I wanted to also talk about sustainable rural communities, an effort that federal agencies are working on right now, and how that will tie into work with the state. So let me...
Before we go on, we did have a question on energy, since you touched on that. Sure. Representative Gardner, would you like to...
Thank you, and I apologize. It might be a little bit off topic for you, but talking about energy in rural Alaska, on St. Paul Island, mm-hmm. there are some wind turbines. Mm-hmm. that I believe were funded with a federal grant. Denali Commission may not have had anything to do with it, and my understanding is they have never been used. Huh. They're sitting there unused because of disputes between the corporation and the local government, which owns the utilities. Do you know if that's accurate? I just find that appalling.
I don't know the story with St. Paul, but I certainly will find
nothing
out.
Nothing to do with Denali Commission.
Well, we may have a hand in it, okay. And I don't know specifically,
right.
But I'll find out and reach out to your office and give you an answer.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Gardner. Mm-hmm. Continue, please.
Thank you. So the $3 million partnership grant, on the left side, it shows the seven power generation projects. These seven have been funded by the commission and the state, and they needed some additional funds to complete, cost escalation. And so $1.6 million will go to those seven so they can move forward. When the commissioners met in December to decide how we would move forward with the $3 million, it was very important to the commissioners that we moved it to construction-ready projects. And so these seven should be in construction this summer. I believe some may already be in construction, and so they'll be able to finish.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. Are those all wind turbine, wind farms?
Representative Foster, through the chair. No, most of them are power generation projects. There may well be a wind turbine or two, but looking at that list, I don't think those communities really have that sort of wind regime that would allow for turbines to make them
diesel, possible. Diesel-based?
Basically, yes.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You said power generation. What do you mean by power generation? What kind of power are we talking about?
Representative Sisna, through the chair. In general, those are diesel generators that are fired, you know, with oil. And so you've got a suite of two, three, or four that serves the community and their varying needs.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, in a huge percentage of the communities that I've visited recently, power generation that comes from diesel is bankrupting communities. And a number of the ones that I've visited are losing their populations really quickly. And what I've seen in the wind turbine story matches ones that I've seen all over, because the people who can operate those kinds of things leave and they go to places where there's plenty of other opportunities with the same knowledge, and they can live a much nicer life, and they leave, and so you're left with high school students trying to figure out how to and you see it in much more already financed, millions of dollars spent on equipment that people with very little knowledge are trying to run. And that's what I mean in terms of sustainability, is, and you said without can't remember exactly which it was, without the storage of fuel, that is oil and gas, there is no sustainability. Yet this is the population that lived here for at least 10,000, probably more years, without those things, and we're making some of those communities disappear. And communities that moved, they did move, but we're harnessing them down in locations, and they can't make it sometimes without being able to be more agile. So I'm really, on this whole issue, extraordinarily concerned, and yet the Denali Commission has done some things, and I'm thinking in health, some fabulous things, yet the way life goes is fabulous things we do have negative things usually always attached to them, right? And the Denali Commission has done a better job than I've seen in the other group in terms of swinging around. And, for instance, one of the later communities, more recent communities I've been to, were trying to get a grant, and Denali Commission has been going through a change in that whole idea of the clinics. And the picture, if I got it right, looked like the clinic in Olegnikik?
I think that was Angoon. I'm not sure.
Was it? Well, it looks very similar to the one in Olegnikik. And, yeah. Well, they're not totally standard. But they're huge sometimes, and they're very fancy. And they're nicer than any of the clinics I've gone to in Anchorage. And you look around the community, and it's non-standard housing. And one of the more impressive clinics I went to was in, Nikolsky.
Representative Sisna, if we
can. Oh, and I'm going too long.
I'm sorry. If we can allow for the continuation of the presentation, then we'll have comments at the end. But Representative Foster has to leave for a subcommittee meeting, so I'd like him to have an opportunity to ask a quick question.
Oh, I'm
or
so.
Or make a statement.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment, and then I do have another committee meeting. But I just wanted to say that
Denali Commission has been a great, great program for all Alaskans throughout the state, and I'm glad to see that not only is infrastructure being built, but the local workforces are being used and people are putting to work and being trained as these are being built. So I just wanted to say thank you for the work that you folks are doing. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Foster. If you can continue, please. Thank you.
We'll come back and we'll address some of those thoughts. On the $3 million match, the commissioners met in December and said, let's get it to projects which are good to go, and we can demonstrate to the legislature that we can take the funds and put them to good projects. On the transportation side, what we looked at is that these mooring projects is a really good opportunity. And I've listed the 17 communities. I don't think we'll have enough money to get to all 17, but we're going to strive to do that. And let me see if I should have some slides about the mooring projects. But the mooring projects are based upon a Corps of Engineers study. This is a useful example of how we do work. We try to do a survey, a scan of the necessary infrastructure needs or the deficiencies, and then we try to come up with solutions and strategies. And that is the particular case with the mooring projects. Now, this slide, if you look up in the upper left-hand corner, you'll see a gentleman with a shovel, a number two round point, and this chain. And that's what a mooring project is. So we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars for that chain. And you're saying, why is that important? Well, let me share with you. You see the barge to the right. Mm-hmm. These barges come on up, they land, and in order to load and unload, they have to keep the tug operating to keep it in place so the river doesn't wash it, you know, downstream. And what does that cause? Well, you know, it costs more for delivery because the tug's operating. The tug's propellers eventually wear out more quickly, and so it's very expensive to replace those. Again, it's more costly for delivery. Chief concern of the community is it creates shoaling. So you've got all this sand and gravel piling up, which is a navigational hazard. There are more than there's many stories of community of boaters hitting these shoals after a tug was there, or after barge was there, and you know, getting tossed in the water. So it is a safety matter. What these mooring points are, we come in and we drive in casing deep into the river. I mean, up to the river embankment, and then you have this chain. Now, in this case, we have a chain because you have snow machiners. You don't want iron pipe sticking out of the ground and they slam into it. So the barge can pull up, tie off, and then you can turn off the engine. So that's what these 17 projects that we're looking at funding would be doing. The transportation program, again, this is we've met, and the Transportation Advisory Committee wanted to commit the $3.9 million and $12.4 million that's available to Waterfront. We have enough funding in place with the $3 million match. We're using a portion of the $3 million partnership match. When we meet in March, the roads project, to review the roads projects, we have $14 million available. And we will have a required match of at least $500,000. What this is that the funding we receive from Federal Highways has a 9% requirement for roads, and the funding received from Federal Transit Authority for Ports and Harbors has a 20% requirement. So unlike the very beginning when we didn't have cost-share match, as we've received new funding streams from the federal government, there have been these cost-share match requirements.
We have a question from Representative Osterman.
On transportation waterfront, when we talk about the $3 million from the state, is it possible that if the state of Alaska invests in other projects, waterfront project docks, harbors, say a new dock being built, the state puts up $9 million, there's still $4 or $5 million still needed. Is that the kind of matching type programs, or is it strictly based upon some other criteria? I'm trying to, because we have also have the Ports and Harbor Fund in DOT that we should be putting more money to. If we put more money into it, does it make those funds eligible for any Denali match?
Representative Osterman, through the chair, we actually have two kinds of approaches. We have those in which the state is a predominant funder and we come in with $1 million. The Transportation Advisory Committee has tried to limit most of the transportation projects we fund to $1 million. The reason being is that if we funded some of the larger ones, very few communities would enjoy these projects. So what we often find is we'll be sort of that last funder on a lot of major ports and harbor projects that the state funds or other folks fund. But then we also have some of the smaller projects, these floats and small projects around Southeast, for example, which can easily be done for $1 million or less. And so we are the primary funder in those. And then we have other folks who come up with funding. Routinely, a lot of those dollars come in from the boroughs themselves, the local communities. But we do have some applicants who do not have the cost share match. And that's how we've been using the state money for those few applicants that do not have cost share match.
Yes.
Specifically to ports and harbors. I mean, they have two different programs within there, one major projects and then the smaller ones like you're talking about.
Right.
And those smaller ones, I think, are a 50-50. I mean, the state will put up 50% of those small projects. If I remember correctly, I could be wrong, but put up 50%. And if it's a $500,000 project, obviously, if the community can come up with $250,000 from Denali, then they could get that project through the ports and harbors. But does ports and harbors fall within that type of a scenario within the Denali Commission's?
Representative Osman, through the chair, we've actually had conversations with DOT specific to that project or to that program, and we're trying to figure out how we can better utilize our mutual resources to serve those communities. And I expect we probably will have something in place within the next year.
Okay. And here we've had several discussions within the legislature in reference to how do we build that fund up a little bit to make these projects more viable, and then the communities then could come out to Denali Commission, for example, and help the funding of the project. So we are having those conversations as well.
May I comment?
Yes, sir.
Representative Osterman, one of the things that I think is that the Commission can offer and has offered in other infrastructure realms is that we will often provide planning and design funding, pre-construction funding, to get the project ready. And I certainly see that as a continued function that the Commission can serve so that these communities, these projects can get ready so that they can then come to the state and say, we have this package ready to go.
Thank you. Representative Dick, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a concern, and maybe I'm speaking out of place, but I've lived on the western side of the Alaska Range for 44 years, and I've seen some huge benefit that's come out of the programs that reach out there. And at the same time, there's some things that are kind of bewildering. And I'm not saying the money came from the Denali folks, but I can think of one project where a village got $250,000 for roads, but nobody in the village has ever owned a car or a truck. There's four four-wheelers, and only two of them are running. And I'm not saying that came from Denali, but I'm just saying that I'm all in favor of seeing money get to villages, money being used to help sustain the villages, you know, keep things going, keep things healthy. But when village people see that type of thing happening, we wonder about dysfunction. Well, that appears to be dysfunction. And when people try to make sense out of things, that doesn't seem to make sense. I'm kind of echoing some of Representative Sisson's concerns. Like another village I can think of, there's just solar panels, total array of solar panels. You didn't do it. But they never produce a bit of electricity for the village. So they're still running diesel generators. And so I think there's a lot of these programs that are wonderful ideas. But if we just say, okay, you know, you've got your solar panels, or okay, you've got your roads, and there's not a reality connection there, I think the message we're communicating is bewildering at best. So I'd like to offer myself as a resource to you. I'm desperately in favor of supporting villages and making sure the out-migration doesn't happen anymore. But at the same time, it's got to make sense. Because part of the out-migration, in my opinion, has to do with things just not making sense. So I'd like to offer myself as a resource to you that any way can help things make sense in the smaller places. I'd love to do that. Thank you,
sir.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you. Continue, please.
On the health program, the state legislative changes, there are two existing bills with funding that's in place, and there's some requirements for kosher match to the Denali Commission. And what we're proposing in response is using the balance of our behavioral health funding to complete these four projects that you see. One is in Galena, a senior assisted living facility. Bethel, Tender Women's Coalition, is primarily serves domestic violence clients. Nugent's Ranch is in the Valley, serves substance abuse, and Seeds of Change is a program to serve children aging out of the foster care program.
Madam Chair.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I think that this is exactly an example, one of the items on here at least, of what Representative Dick is talking about. Nugent's Ranch, I looked at their report yesterday, their annual report to the legislature. They had 50 people who started their program. 40 completed it. Of the 40, they have a follow-up, and they say after their follow-up, which I think is only 6 months, but I'm not certain. So if we have substance abuse treatment successfully completed, I would say a six-month follow-up is inadequate to make a decision about whether those people are still sober. That's the first thing. But of the 20 that they lost track of, and I'm just remembering, I think it was 16 they spoke to friends and family who said, oh, yeah, he's still sober. And they're calling that a 72% success rate. I would say it's nowhere near that. I would say a one-year follow-up is standard. I mean, and I am completely in support of doing everything we can to address substance abuse and to have treatment available for people who say, I am ready for treatment, I want to stop drinking. We can't afford to do anything less. But I just, and I love the philosophy of Nugent's Ranch, where people are working and supposedly learning a skill and living communally and a host of things that I think support an effort towards sobriety. But you look at their numbers, and I don't buy it. I just don't think that that's a very good use of state resources. So that's exactly, I think, what Representative Dick is talking about in other contexts.
Go. Continue, please.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, I'll research it and get back to you.
Thank you.
And as we know, we're currently working with Karen Rayfeld and the department, as well as the Mental Health Trust Authority, on the suite of four projects.
Representative Sadler and then Representative Sisnov, if you can keep it very brief, I'd like to complete the presentation and then allow for some questions.
I'll make it real quick.
Thank you.
The Chair, Joel, just because we're at the health program right now, you said that my question, you said some of the behavioral health money is going away. Is that Mental Health Trust money or is it GF money, and why is it going away?
Representative Sadler, through the Chair, that's Denali Commission funding. And what we have, when we were receiving $40, $30 million a year annually from HRSA, you know, Department of Health and Human Services, a federal agency, we would fund a broad array of projects, primary care, hospitals, behavioral health, senior living, so on and so forth. But as the funding has declined in that stream, it's been the approach of the Health Steering Committee and ratified by the commissioners to use most of those funds in primary care. And so what we have is we have this older federal funds that particularly identify for behavioral health and particularly a good portion for the Bring the Kids Home initiative in partnership with the state. And so we have this essentially legacy money. And so our idea is how do we use the remaining balance of this federal fund and then wrap it up gracefully.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sisna.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to do this as quickly as possible. I know I did get carried away there, but one of our problems is the fact that we're dealing with many, many different issues across a state that's different worlds, and on this, things like spending money on one of the areas that we have a real serious problem with, and that's drug abuse, but other kinds of things, suicide, all those kinds of things. You've been spending monies that play into all of that. Actually, all of your programs play into that. And what we need to do as a committee, as a state, is to develop to really study and develop science evidence-based standards that really do fit, and we really haven't done that. We as a state don't study enough all of the communities that you serve. You're out there working with a lot of those communities, and we don't, as I understand it, have any standards on, for instance, what kind of recovery is there in all of our different programs. And we need to be spending our money together, and that's one of those silo issues that you've been working with probably more transparency. You're in a more transparent silo than many of our federal state cooperative things are. But I think we do need to get there where we know what we're spending our money on is well-spent money. Thank you.
Representative Sisna. Thank you.
Let me address the energy program and a significant change in the way the Denali Commission will be doing business, whether it's this year or next year and thereafter. In the federal fiscal year 11 president's budget, there is language that requires a cost share match out of our base budget, and of which I can speak openly about this, is expected to be about $12 million. I can't speak about everything else. But of that $12 million, there will be a requirement of a 20% cost share match for economically distressed communities and 50% for non-distressed. So an economically distressed community would be Tunta Tuliak, and non-distressed would be Bethel. So there's this requirement that heretofore has only applied in the health program, and it is in language. We do not know, none of us knows, what's going to happen with the president's budget, how Congress is going to respond. So we're sitting back waiting to find out what happens. It is possible. We've seen two different bills. One bill, this requirement is in it, and another bill, it is not. So if the bill that is not there, then we do not have a cost share requirement for this year. But that's not the end of the story. We do know that federal OMB is very insistent on this cost share match, and it is quite likely it'll end up in reauthorization. If it doesn't end up in reauthorization, what we expect is each and every year thereafter, OMB, federal OMB, will put this language in the president's budget. So if it's not there, they'll be driving the ship on this point. This is in large part to make the Denali Commission look more like the other regional commissions, which have a very prescribed cost-share match. And so that's what this effort is about. So in our energy program, I provided a range. It's $4.5 million to $15 million. I don't know what the answer will be. Again, we don't know how much we're getting, nor do we know which communities will be served, so therefore we don't know if they're distressed or non-distressed. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Wait a minute. I had Representative Dick and then Representative Gardner. Thank you.
And I hope you forgive me. I'm just new to all this, so I'm just learning and catching up. So. But my question is, where we do have state and federal revenue cost sharing, then in terms of overseeing the projects themselves, does the state then have part of the oversight in those projects and seeing whether they're working well or how they're being shaped?
Representative Dick, through the chair, yes. If we have program partners, whether the federal or state, and we joint funding, it's routine that, you know, we are collaborating together so that we're getting common reports and we're doing common analysis to see that the work that is funded is completed on time, on schedule, on budget, and within the scope. Thank you.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Quick question. The cost share match, is that state funds to match or the community is to match?
Representative Gardner, through the chair, it'll be through the community this year. Now, what I'm sharing with you is if we learn in March that through the continuing resolution process that there is a match required, what I suspect will happen is that in time, the sophisticated communities which have been identified for funding for Denali Commission projects will be coming to you, will be coming to the legislature. So you may have a deluge of communities coming to you, and you're having to deal with a whole bunch of communities. Or it may be that the legislature will say, well, let's not do that. Let's find another alternative. It's not my position to tell you what to do or to give you advice on that. I just know that this is coming, and it's something we're all going to have to deal with.
Okay, one more, and then let's wrap it up and continue, because we just have about five more slides, and then we can ask more
Thank
questions.
Thank you. Just to confirm my understanding, so it's not – the federal requirement of matching is not like when you take out a mortgage and you have to have a certain amount of your own money and it can't be borrowed. The idea is that you personally have an investment in what's happening, and if they're requiring a cost share, it's not just a funding mechanism, but – also to have a local investment.
Representative Gardner, through the chair, yes, that's predominantly what
Thank
I
you.
Believe is the case. Moving on, as I mentioned, there are four major programs, and we identify government coordination as another program, and that is all this, mm-hmm. is all this interaction between different agencies and stakeholders and communities, helping communities try to identify their dreams of how to improve and how we can partner with them.
Can we wait until the end? We're almost done. Okay, thank you.
Before I took this post last January, I was already notified that the delegation was very interested that the commission take lead on what has been termed sustainable rural communities. It was an interesting question. I'd never heard this question posed this way, but I thought it was fascinating and a very good first step. The question posed is, how can federal services, programs, and projects be delivered to rural Alaska more efficiently? What are our barriers amongst the family of federal agencies that prevent efficient delivery of services? So we're not talking about what do we do about the price of oil being $8 a gallon. What we're talking about is our regulations, our policies, and the family of federal agencies that create barriers, perhaps some of the barriers you were talking about, that just don't make sense. And when we started the discussion this time last year, what we found is a craving amongst the federal agencies to have this conversation. They really hadn't had a conversation about some of the common issues that we all face. And so what we've done is we've produced this first report that was produced in July, in which the federal agencies up here identified barriers. We put it out for public comment. We've received those public comments. And we're now going through the process of develop a supplemental report. Let me go back and just highlight some of the major findings that the federal agencies came up with. Federal agencies felt that it was important to have a lead agency involved in a project. As an example, NEPA, the environmental requirements, reporting requirements, and documentation. Not always do we work together, and so you may have two separate lead agencies working on it, and it creates confusion and unnecessary costs and can slow a project down. The other is that there needs to be a focus on community, and it was interesting, the public comments came back, and they felt that was the number one priority, so we're working on those details. And so what we want to do is we want to find solutions at the federal level, and once we figure out how to solve our problems, and some of our issues, then we want to start reaching out to program partners. We want to reach out to the state. We want to reach out to tribes. We want to reach out to cities and boroughs and start working on some of these larger questions. So the congressional delegation, I thought was a fascinating approach, is that first look inward to yourselves, federal agencies. Address some of those easy things, those easy barriers. And once you've done that, then start having a dialogue with other program partners. And the report should be out in the next couple months, the supplemental. The last thing, and I'll finish with this, is we are holding listening sessions. You'll see a packet in there, a white paper, one-page white paper, in which we are asking Alaskans to provide us their input on these three questions. What are we doing right? What are we not doing that we should be doing or could be doing, and how can we improve? Now, this is all to provide input to the delegation and stakeholders on reauthorization of the commission. I spoke earlier that we will be reauthorized. We're calling these listening, we're calling them listening sessions because this is really what the commission's about and what we should be focusing on. And so we want to get, after 10 years of work in rural Alaska, $1 billion, 2,100 projects, what are we doing right and what should we be doing different? I think that's a fundamental question that needs to be asked and answered. So we'll have at least these, or we have at least one session already scheduled, and we've got these two additionally, and we're working with to try to schedule additional sessions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Niemeyer. Appreciate your presentation today. Are there questions? Representative Sisna.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And I have two. One, going back to the funding sources and what's being looked for. In-kind, are in-kind efforts included in funding sources? Because so many of these communities have no money. Money isn't what they're operating on. And well, they're trying to, but they don't have the sources for that money. And if people actually are out there volunteering efforts to build some of these things, all of a sudden they have invested. And if that is included, then I think that changes how much effort people will go to keep something in place, how much they feel it really belongs to them. Is that acceptable?
Representative Sisna, through the chair, to some degree it is acceptable. I've worked for 26 years putting rural projects on the ground, and my experience has been with in-kind contributions that they can easily be gamed. I'll give you an example. The community will make a commitment to allow the loader, the dump trucks, and all this available on your project. And then when it comes time to use them, they're being used elsewhere. And so there's this commitment made, and the follow-through may not always be there. So what we've done as an agency, and I can say I was the one who pushed for it back in 99 and 2000, is that we wanted easily measurable and quantifiable in-kind contributions, so land, gravel, those sort of things. We start looking at labor and whatnot, it gets very difficult to measure that, and then we're being asked to essentially be this policeman of measuring, and it just is very difficult. So we allow some components, but not the traditional labor part.
Okay,
and more follow-up?
The second question is, you've got three sites listening, the listening sessions, very important. And actually what I've been thinking is that what we need is communication. It is a huge thing, but it needs to be between the U.S., the state, because that communication is huge, the state and the local governments, that's a real huge necessary thing, and the people who in all of these constitutions keep on being mentioned as the ones in charge are the people themselves, and it's not just those people who can afford a lobbyist. It's those people out there that are the ones that are actually being affected by this stuff. Are any of these having video teleconferencing to get into villages?
Representative Sisna, through the chair. No, we're not. We haven't gone to video conferencing. What we're doing is we're actually sending letters with our annual work plan, asking for written comments from the communities. These Nome and Bethel are staged around, Nome is a annual meeting of CWARC. So CWARC is paying for a number of their representatives and stakeholders to come in, and so we're piggybacking on that. Bethel, the ABCP Housing Authority, is hosting a meeting, and we're piggybacking on that. So that's what we're trying to do is piggyback on existing regional conferences and meetings so that we can have a larger group of folks that participate.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Osterman?
Thank you. I've got one question and then a comment. The question deals with your total energy budget and what percentage of the energy funds that you spend are towards alternative energy versus the hydrocarbon aspects of village life. It would seem to me that over time we would be that alternative energy portion of that budget would be increasing and hopefully decreasing the hydrocarbon burning. So can you speak to that and what your future plans are in reference to moving that direction?
Certainly, Representative Osman, through the chair. Mm-hmm. We have last year, and it's proposed this year, and it'll be up to the commissioners to make the choice. Last year, we funded a little over $3 million for the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, and this year we have on the table proposed for the commissioners to consider $2.4 million. So we are starting down that path. Within the portfolio of typical power projects, we are doing some wind energy. We're doing some exploration, say, like on hydrokinetic and those sort of things. But the bread and butter really is the core infrastructure, the core electrical infrastructure. I like to think of sort of that vanilla, Neapolitan ice cream. You know, if you do not have a power plant that is state of the art and up to date, all those other ancillary and alternative improvements will not align, will not work well. And so, a role that the commission has been playing, I think, in partnership, gets back to the cooperative programming. In large part, the state has taken a lot of effort in the alternative arena, and we've been working on that bread and butter stuff so that those improvements can align and merge readily into the community electrical power generation system.
Did you have a follow-up?
Yeah,
yes,
question.
One.
And
then,
I also noticed that one of your partners is AVAC, and my experience a few years back when I was dealing with discussions with AVAC and the power systems out there was that the communities they were dealing with, because of the system that they have across the board where they amortize the cost to everybody, they would put a Caterpillar in this community and a NC machine in this community, and then they would have all different filters and injectors, and it didn't seem like it was very efficient in their operational cost of operation. And obviously, if you have people who are going across the board looking at these things or maintaining them, then they have to maintain different machines at different communities and different. So has that changed? Is it a more efficient operation through your partners with AVAC?
Representative Osman, through the chair, AVAC has been a wonderful partner over the years. They've committed in the very beginning to provide 10% cost share match to each project. So they've been doing it essentially walking the talk when you get to the question of local involvement and ownership of the project. To the specific matter, I don't know if I could answer it today, but I will get an answer for you. My supposition on this is that a lot of those, the example you provided, is maybe a legacy of AVEC allowing a community to join their membership, and so they're accepting them in with their existing technology. And so that technology would have been developed under a different regime, and so I suspect that that's maybe what you've seen. But I will find out and report back to you.
It just seems more efficient if it was,
yes, sir.
You know, and I realize that one sole source type provider may be a problem in reference to the bidding contracts and stuff, but from the cost factor of how much money both the state and the federal government put into those systems, it seems like it would be better. And my follow-up comment is I've watched the Denali Commission for a long time, and I'm very appreciative of the efforts that you guys have put into the state of Alaska and the way you do it. I've been involved in the past and have traveled the communities that I represent with members of the Denali Commission to talk about the projects that are out there and that people are looking for. In the system that you guys used of sustainability, of not putting money into a community just because they want it, but into a community that will sustain that development, is the way that the state should be doing things as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And my final comment is I can see just looking down the road, obviously, in the federal funding side, when you're $14 trillion in the hole, of the decline in federal funding coming to your program, to every program, and the need for the state to stand up a little bit. And my suggestion to you would be, if the state's going to stand up, you need support from the legislative body to do that in funding. Prior to you coming on board, I made several trips around my district with members from the Denali Commission to look at different projects and talk about them and give insight. It hasn't been offered for quite a while to take, at least me as a legislator, maybe you're taking other ones out, but to take some of the legislators every now and then along with you to have that conversation so that you can get a little bit better connected with the legislature and legislature a little more connected with you guys if in the future we're going to put more money into it, which I think we should, but just a suggestion. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Osterman. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joel, actually, my question kind of builds on what Representative Osterman's was. You spoke of the reauthorization of the Denali Commission. What's the next stage for the commission? What's perhaps the end stage? Looking at your chart here, I can see funding going down. So what's the future funding? And I got a follow-up for you, too. how might the mission change, too, I guess, in the future?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, there is no doubt that federal funds are reduced and will probably continue to be reduced. And expectation in D.C. that states will pick up a larger load. So I expect that to be in play. Quite frankly, I think the key to the Denali Commission's success in future years is our transportation program. If it remains robust and viable, then we can serve as a sort of a, I don't want to say a clearinghouse, but a convener, so that we can get the federal agencies to come together. I recall the discussion back in 99 and 2000 on sustainability. And I was there when the commissioners passed a resolution on sustainability. It was unheard of at the time, and it was very controversial and created all kinds of angst on many different parties at many different levels. But today it's common, and I think that really is the magic of the commission. Can we continue serving in that role? And there's a certain dollar figure, and I don't know what it is, but there's a certain dollar figure in which folks will pay attention to you. And I don't know where we'll bottom out, and hopefully it'll be at a point where we continue to have a voice and continue to bring people together so that they want to convene and talk about issues of the day, whether they are sustainable projects or now about sustainable communities and what makes sense.
And one quick follow-up, looking at the chart here, I think if I can read the key correctly, the Environmental Protection Agency funding is increasing. And just curious, if I'm reading that correctly, what are they funding specifically and why?
Representative Sadler, through the chair, the EPA funding is no longer there. That is a that's a hard graph to read.
It is a bit.
It is, but in essence, what it shows is that over the years, Senator Stevens and the delegation were able to identify platforms, legislative platforms, to provide funding to the commission. And one of them was the EPA. Just as HRSA was a platform, Department of Labor was a platform. So we've had these different platforms. And as those authorities wind down or end, they haven't been brought back.
Okay. And you say you think that, with your permission,
sure,
you think that the future for Denali Commission would be more surface transportation or waterfronts and harbors, or you made some allusion to that?
Oh, Representative Sadler, through the chair. In my mind, the more we can do in waterfront ports and harbors, I think is a good step. But if we have a transportation, we'll always be doing both. And I think if you look at it, you have Bureau of Indian Affairs and State of Alaska and Denali Commission doing surface roads. So you've got three agencies out there doing it, but you don't have that many agencies doing waterfront. You have the commission and you have the state. Okay. So you can just look at it that way and say there's not as many funding streams to do that kind of work.
One comment. On the listening sessions, do you plan to have a session down in Southeast?
We have send out to regional players requests to host a listening session. We've not heard from folks in Southeast. We'd love to have one in Southeast. And if you want to help organize one, we'd be enthusiastic.
Great. Thank you. Representative Cisna.
Real quickly, and this is unfair, but you said waterfront, and I'm just thinking waterfront. How many, and I'm thinking waterfront, thinking river as water too. Mm-hmm. How many communities are there in the state, do you know, that are waterfront?
I'd conjecture over 90%, 95%. I mean, it's a rare community that does not have a waterfront port or harbor. So it's and so much economic development and so many goods go across those ports and harbors. It is part of the lifeblood of the community.
Thank you. One more follow-up, and then we will...
Yeah, just a comment. I believe it's not only an incredible need for the communities, but actually urban centers make a lot of money off of rural. Am I not right?
Thank you, Representative Cisna. Thank you for your proposal, or for your presentation today. It's been very informative. I really appreciate your work and the work of the other commissioners. Also, I think it's important to recognize the input and vision that U.S. Senator Ted Stevens had in forming this commission and the many, many impacts, that positive impacts that it has had over the years. So he's done so many things. He did so many things for Alaska, but certainly this was his vision, and it's been very positive. So thank you again, and if there are additional questions that committee members have, we can submit them to me, the chair, and I would be happy to follow up with the commission. All right. With nothing else before the committee, our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, February 3rd. We will continue with overviews from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development, as well as a presentation from Serve Alaska. We will also have a continuation on the bill that we heard today, HB 65, the Senior Citizen Grant Fund proposal. So with nothing else before the committee, we are adjourned. Thank you.